Welcome to SpEducation, the special education podcast by SpEducators and for SpEducators, where we discuss all things related to special education, or as I like to say, SpEducation, from the point of view of professionals working in the field. I'm Sarah Perkins, a nationally certified school psychologist currently practicing in a junior high in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I'm Leanne McElwain. I'm a special ed teacher at an elementary school and have a background in secondary schools as well.
This episode will continue with discussing the Six Shifts to Improve Special Education and Other Interventions book by Nathan Levinson that we talked about last time. Last time we talked about his first of his six shifts, and today we're going to start with shift two. So shift two is from more adults to more time. So he talks here about, rather than having adults like pushing in, making sure adults, kids get more time with the correct adults. Mm-hmm. So it's related to me to shift one.
Right, because they're looking for more time with the highly qualified or highly skilled teachers.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I guess I struggled with this because, like we've talked about in the previous episode, I feel like, once again, it always comes back to scheduling. Mm-hmm. So I sort of wish that he'd put the scheduling shift earlier.
Right.
I guess maybe he put it near the end to fix all the problems. But
and I did notice also that he broke it up at the elementary level and then the secondary level.
Yes. And mm-hmm. I sort of liked that, actually.
Mm-hmm. It does make sense because there's different needs for those.
Yes. And I find, maybe not in literature so much, but at least in our conversations within our district, it tends to be elementary-centric. And then when we say, oh, but are we doing that secondary? They're like, oh, secondary? And so I sort of liked that he acknowledged that, no, there are different needs and mm-hmm. they both need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. So I did think that was positive.
Yes.
So he talks a lot about how having more adults working with fewer students is not necessarily the best thing. That rather, like you said, having adults maybe working with full class sizes worth of students, but who are well qualified to teach the subject is the best thing.
Yes.
And he says, and I think this is, I don't know, tell me what you think of this. He says, almost all educators believe more adults, either SPED or Gen Ed, will improve outcomes. And I think that he's sort of right there, that we tend to think if only we had more staff.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just based on my professional experience and different capacities, I think that is kind of the first thought that comes to mind. If only we had more people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I found even recently, I attended a staff meeting where we were talking about next year, and our district is going to be now down a bit in terms of student population. So my principal is saying, you know, when she looked at her budget for next year, her goal was to prioritize staff over anything else, which on like a human level, like an HR level, is good for morale, mm-hmm. right? But I wonder from a school outcomes level, if it's actually best to always prioritize staff. Mm-hmm. The problem is, I know, like personally, I don't necessarily want to say, well, I think you should get rid of that guy's job.
Right.
But I do, and when she was talking in our staff meeting, it made me think about this book. And I was like, is it good to always say, well, at the end of the day, the most important thing is saving jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good for staff, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's like a good PR strategy.
Right, exactly.
But I can't say that that's the best way to evaluate how to spend money.
Yeah. He did say, like you said, he talked about exactly how he did the more time. And he said in his district, they made a commitment that all struggling readers, which it sounded like they defined as scoring below a certain point on a reading assessment or maybe a couple of reading assessments. He didn't get into a lot of mm-hmm. how they defined them. Mm-hmm. Got an extra 30 minutes of reading instruction a day. And if they were really struggling or they didn't grow with the intervention, they got even more reading time. Mm-hmm. And he said in elementary, they integrated social studies with ELA time. So they eliminated social studies altogether mm-hmm. to free up time. And then they flooded each grade level and made groups according to skill, which sounds like it's not necessarily intervening with struggling. Like, sounds like everybody got something? Mm-hmm. Is that how you read
right.
it?
Right. Well, I was imagining it very similar to how I understand the PLC process. And you're just constantly looking at that data, seeing which kids didn't get didn't understand to the degree that you want, and then identifying which teachers are good at teaching that skill, and then shifting the groups.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it sounded like, when I was reading it, that they were sort of having, like, one grade level would do that flood time at a time, and then they'd get, like, all the sped teachers or any mm-hmm. auxiliary staff would support that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said for secondary, they set aside an extra period for intervention, aka like taking in elective slots, which is what we do in our secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, he said only one subject at secondary at least got doubled up. So they didn't have kids in like a reading intervention and a math intervention.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like at all. It really sounds like he focused on reading.
Yeah.
That was my vibe.
Yes.
And then he talked about group size. I found this really interesting. He said that that What Works Clearinghouse and the mm-hmm. National Institute of Health report more, no meaningful difference in outcomes in groups of one versus five students.
Right? I found that interesting.
I did too. First of all, I do like What Works Clearinghouse in general.
Me too.
But I also think that this is sort of a basic tenet of education, and especially of special education or like interventions, that smaller groups are better.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying basically no mm-hmm. was the vibe I got.
Up to five.
Yeah, right.
1 to 5.
So he said that. So I wasn't clear what if he, because he used that research, but then I sort of got the impression he was going for, he'd rather kids be in a full-size class mm-hmm. with a highly skilled reading teacher than a group of five with somebody who doesn't have any special background in reading.
Right.
Is that your impression?
I was wondering that as well. Like,
it wasn't clear to me,
but I did get the sense that he was a proponent of having kids in the full-size classroom.
Yeah.
And he even makes a point that, like, great, he talks after that, after what you were talking about, he talks about co-teaching, that good things can happen with co-teaching, but that it's challenging. And I really felt like he was making the argument, the key is to have the kids with the teacher that is highly qualified and also demonstrate success
mm-hmm.
in teaching. Like class size doesn't matter at that point, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think if you asked him, well, I can either have groups of seven with this teacher who has no special background or shown any skill in this, or I can have groups of 25 with this teacher who has shown to rock in reading.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't quite imply this, but he strongly implied that he would go for the groups of 25.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then I think we talked a little bit about this last week, but where he's talking about how special ed kids in a gen ed setting, if they have a question, the class doesn't stop. The mm-hmm. a paraprofessional will try to help them, but that is not actually best. It is better to treat that student as a part of the whole class
mm-hmm.
and backup if there needs to be backup.
Yeah, absolutely. And then he had a whole list of things that, you know, these are some things schools do but are not
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a big one was, like, don't replace time, which we talked about last time is what my school does, right? Like, we pull them out of general ed, not always, but we pull them out of general ed math and put them in special ed math. And he mm-hmm. said, that's not extra time. That's replacing time.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, and this is another thing my school does. Purchase programs cannot drive extra time.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that our district at the secondary level, I'm not sure, less clearly at the elementary, but very clearly at the secondary level, has said reading intervention equals a purchased program that is implemented on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
That is the only thing it equals. And he's saying, nope, he really wants to lean on those skilled professionals, mm-hmm. not curriculum, which I like.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, resource room is not extra time. Which I think is hard
mm-hmm.
as a sped educator to hear.
Well, I think it's about having a realistic view on what can happen in those settings. And when they're out of the classroom, they are not getting tier one. So it doesn't equal extra time.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
When he does say, and I wanted your thoughts on this, he said, don't treat students with disabilities worse than gen ed students. And the example he gave is he said, resource room help that does not have direct instruction is worse than extra time. And he a few times in this book, envisions resource room instruction as a resource teacher with multiple kids in their room who are working on very different things. And so the kids are doing a lot of independent work with the resource room teacher checking in.
Mm-hmm.
And is that, do you think that's, he's painting too broad a brush, or do you think that's actually is how resource rooms usually are?
I think that is how they, by default, end up being, because you have so many students that need that extra assistance that they will end up, especially at the elementary level, there can end up being on any given time multiple kids, multiple grade levels participating in different tasks. Like some might be receiving assessment accommodations and others might be receiving support for a writing assignment. But it depends on classroom schedules and what's happening that week.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. It makes me sort of think, and maybe this is a little unfair, but I almost feel like the premise of an IEP is not something that he thinks is valuable. Because he says, like, you know, the I in IEP stands for individualized, they all have different goals. But I think he sort of thinks, I'd rather just have them all get instruction in reading. I feel like he's sort of like, yeah, like, you just, like, take that away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't, and I don't know mm-hmm. that he necessarily values that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what I'm picking up on is kind of that, a realistic view of what is actually happening. Right? Being like, yes, we can make an IEP, and we all kind of have these rose-colored glasses on as to how magical it's going to be. And then when it comes to the day-to-day, how much of that actually happens? And, I mean, would it be better for the students to continue to be in Tier 1 and then get that very targeted intervention that is additional time?
Mm-hmm.
But the impossible thing is that there's already so many hours that students spend in schools, and where does the time come from?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think he's looking at ways to maybe improve the outcome of the time spent. And I think it has been found that teacher ability or teacher effectiveness is the number one.
The biggest, like,
yeah.
impact.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. When you said about, like, there's not much time, that makes me think about, you know, he's like, in my school, we, like, collapsed social studies. But I was thinking, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I remember, the elementary, there's not a half an hour of social studies every day now in our day. Like, we wouldn't gain a half hour by doing that. We'd gain, like, maybe an hour a week. Is that correct?
I think our elementary schedule, at least with sixth graders, they have social studies every day for about a half hour.
Oh, they do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But that's the sixth graders, and I think that can somewhat depend on the teachers and what they choose to do with their time, and then, like, if their curriculum builds in not project-based learning, but some cross content learning, there could be social studies covered
within the ELA.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting because he says, it seems to me that our district has sort of pushed for more ELA yep. recently,
mm-hmm.
and their new curriculum is like 90 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. But he's sort of saying it shouldn't be more for everybody. It really should be more for the struggling readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I almost made me think that if we could ask him, would he be down with us saying, look, given that our ELA time has increased for everybody, maybe we could pull from that time. Or maybe mm-hmm. we could decrease that again and then pull from that time and have the other kids do more science and social studies or enrichment activities.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yep. I just think I haven't gotten a clear idea, and maybe it's because of the way I've read it or I don't know. I haven't gotten a clear idea or a real strong connection to what he's suggesting as actually working.
Yeah, it feels not quite operational.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Like, you sort of get senses, but then when you think about, like, how would I do this in my school, it's hard to visualize.
Yes. Yep.
I agree. Ooh, another question I had about this as I was sort of reading it is I was thinking, so what he needs is more teachers who are exceptional at teaching primarily reading. That's mm-hmm. his prime, which I think that's fair that that's his primary focus. Mm-hmm. Or their time freed up from doing other things, and then potentially less time for speducators to teach. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, I'm like, is he envisioning speducators as more consultants or like tracking the kids' goals maybe within that reading intervention or something? It sounds like he, I think, rightly says it's unreasonable to ask speducators to be experts in all their content areas and all disabilities and IEP paperwork, and, which that's true, it is. Mm-hmm. But I am not clear that he's therefore asking, therefore speducators should specialize in reading. It sounds like he's more saying, therefore a general ed expert in reading should do it. Mm-hmm. So I don't see, like, when I try to envision, like, what would you as a speducator do all day in Mr. Levinson's school? Mm-hmm. I'm not clear. I don't know. Were you?
No, I'm not clear.
Yeah.
I was just looking back at some of his figures, and I think it goes into the next chapter a little bit more.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Shifting from generalist to specialist, but the last paragraph in chapter two, I mean, he does sum up that core instruction's foundational, but not enough. Then he says the extra instructional time targets the students with specific needs.
Which sounds like special ed, but
yes.
It's not, he's saying.
No, well, he's like core instruction. So everybody's getting core instruction, and then there's extra instructional time for the students with specific needs. And then we're looking at who delivers the core instruction, and then the extra instruction raising achievement.
Yeah.
Then he goes into the next chapter why the person providing the instruction can't just be anyone.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's talk about
okay.
that chapter, shift three, from
okay.
generalist to specialist. Because,
okay.
yeah, that is a big – they're all sort of related. And I feel
yeah.
like these two shifts especially are related.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he says, like, you can't just have any teacher – it sounds like he's saying providing core instruction, but especially providing that intervention.
Right. And then he says, looking back at history, it's hard to decipher why we used to think that struggling students would benefit from a generalist, which is what special ed teachers
are.
Typically are. And then because he's saying that those teachers, they've been asked to do it all. So why would they be an expert or highly effective at that?
Which he's not wrong, but
right.
it again feels like one of those solutions that's too big to actually. So it's like, so what you're asking is to revamp special ed training programs
mm-hmm.
and the envision and how their role is implemented and envisioned in all schools everywhere, which is like sort of major.
Right. And it really shifts. If you think about PLCs, I think PLCs are more easily implemented at an elementary level because there's fewer staff members. It is nice at the secondary level because you can get a group of highly qualified experts in math together, and then they can teach the students the skills that they are best at teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that would potentially require, excellent teamwork, camaraderie, and then also a willingness to shift students' schedules, which with hundreds of kids, that could be a little tricky.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes more difficult. And I can't imagine that there would be a shift to, at the elementary level. Well, I take that back. So I did hear about a school last year where the special ed teachers were divided by content at the elementary level. They had one special ed teacher that provided reading. They had one special ed teacher that provided math, and then also then writing.
Hmm.
It just, for other reasons, like case management, can become a little more cumbersome.
Yeah, well, and I think maybe I am biased by the exact lens that he has a problem with, that sort of special ed lens, because when you were saying that, I was like, ooh, I like that idea of, because in our district, most of the time, if there's more than one special educator in elementary school, they're split by grades,
mm-hmm.
like K-2
mm-hmm.
and then 3-6.
Right.
So I was like, ooh, that'd be more meaningful to split them by subject.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, the case management thing could be weird. And then you have to really make sure those two special educators have their schedules coordinated with each other in a way that you don't have to when you're split by grades. But then the other thought I had was, but is there something to be said for being a specialist in that developmental range? Because 12-year-olds and 5-year-olds are not the same. And I could see somebody really being very knowledgeable about 5-year-olds and really clicking with them and understanding how to interact with them and struggling with 12-year-olds or vice versa. And I feel like that's also specialized knowledge that maybe we're not quite acknowledging in this. I don't know.
Right. He seems very content skill focused rather than age development, like you said, or even disability focused if you have.
See, so that's another point, because a lot of our schools lately have been talking about moving towards more specialized programming for like students who maybe don't haven't traditionally qualified for specialized program in our district, but maybe need support, like students with autism who have been traditionally in our district just within the resource room, but maybe need a different touch. And he seems to sort of say that's not nearly as important as being good at reading.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if he's hung out with a lot of kids with autism and tried to teach them reading.
Right.
Because I think that is, I mean, the first step to teaching is engaging. And if you can't even engage with the kid.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I'm on the fence because I do think he has a point, too.
I do, too. And I think in our past work together, when we've tried to address different challenges that have come up in the work, and it seems like every time we have found a solution, there's always these unintended consequences that come along. And I couldn't say, I mean, I appreciate his work, and he does, he is giving it a try from with his lens, but it doesn't seem to be without issues. And if this were implemented, I would imagine that there would then be unintended consequences and things that you would have to then go back and address.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I feel like some of those unintended consequences, he tends to just, as he was saying, well, if you have gen ed content experts provide interventions, that would impact funding because SPED services are provided by SPED educators who are paid through SPED. And he's like, but it'll probably work out.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that seems... And then he's another point, he says, well, if you have like one person specializing in, you know, phonics reading instruction, well, they probably wouldn't be busy all day in one building, but like no big deal. Just have them drive around, which is fine, I guess. But I'm like, being itinerant comes with its own unexpected consequences. And especially in a state like ours, I mean, we're lucky we work in a city. It wouldn't be that hard to be itinerant. But in some of our, you know, towns in Wyoming, that could add an hour commute time. And he's like, no, yeah, it'd be fine. So I don't love that.
I mean, it's interesting. So there's just this one part kind of towards the end of the chapter, but he says he's often asked why we can't give all kids 100% of core instruction and extra time to learn as well and deal with the challenge of who provides this instruction later. Isn't 2 out of 3 shifts a big step in the right direction? And then he says the answer is no, and that that has ultimately led to the drawbacks or issues that we're seeing today. So really, I mean, he's just focusing, his true focus is highly qualified, effective teaching, and the other things are just, I think, left to fall in line.
Yeah, which is a good focus, but it sort of feels like it's like shutting down. Like it doesn't count unless you do it exactly my way. The other thought I had related to that, he's like, well, allow people to have different needs and specialize differently, which I think is a great idea. Like one example he gave about that was SPED specific is he said, maybe you have people break off and do like IEP paperwork and then other people focus on like SPED reading, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah.
But I suspect, and maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect that if you were to take all of the SPED educators in our district and say, we're going to have you all specialize in a particular area, we would end up with nobody specializing in, like, junior high level reading. We'd end up with people who are interested in paperwork, people who are interested in, like, elementary reading, people who are interested in high school. But certain areas would just, people would not be into. And we'd end up with too many who wanted to do paperwork or too many who wanted to do reading. And he tends to sort of blow that off, I feel like. And I think the same is true of general ed. If we said, hey, general ed, we're going to provide you training to become really specialized in an area, I think more would be interested in reading than math, which maybe isn't the end of the world. But I wonder if it would balance out. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that he's talking about, in when he's talking beyond that core instruction, being with someone highly skilled, all additional teaching beyond that is provided by a paraprofessional?
Well, he did say that he doesn't think paras should take the place of teachers.
Yeah.
And that he actually sees paras doing more of that than, like, schools think, oh, my para doesn't teach, but then when you actually dig into their schedule, you find out they are.
Yeah.
So I sort of feel like he's thinking, like, maybe the not skilled teachers, but I'm envisioning, like, being a principal and being like, so you sort of suck.
Yeah, and so, then, yeah.
Like, that feels awkward.
And how does that person build the capacity, you know?
Right? Hmm. Like, wouldn't you want them to grow, or would you maybe go to them and say, hey, I've noticed your class is not really growing in reading. Maybe you want to be a math interventionist. Mm-hmm. And that's how you approach it?
Right.
But then, like, none of that could happen overnight. Mm-hmm. Like, let's pretend that at your elementary school, your principal wanted to do this, and all the teachers loved it, and they wanted to get trained to be specialists in their particular area.
Mm-hmm.
Then, like, that would be at least a year,
yeah,
like, minimum,
right,
to get trained, and somebody would pay for that, and then you'd have to have them presumably out of the building and mm-hmm. have subs, and we all know how I feel about the availability of subs.
Right.
He says at one point, like, you could have teacher coaches, but those are only effective if you have one per every 20 teachers, which there's more than 20 teachers at your elementary school.
Yes.
Let alone my junior high.
Right.
So that's a lot of coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, oh, you could replicate college courses. So then are you going to pay a college educator?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just have lots of questions about, like, the logistics of how would you do that?
Yeah. And so that's what got me wondering. And then I was looking at his appendix items for this chapter, and they're all related to paraprofessional usage. Mm. And he has, like, he has a table 4.1 that is matching support to best meet student needs.
Mm.
He has there a column for non-paraprofessional. Much of it, I mean, a couple of things are reliant on peer support.
Oh, yeah.
And then he has the paraprofessional management process for the district. And then 4B has students' abilities and support matrix, which is interesting to look in those areas and then say, okay, what can the student do? So I guess he's talking about, like, this makes me think that he's talking about classroom time is with teachers. That's core instruction. I'm unclear as to where he sees the special ed teachers fitting.
I am too.
Because the co-teaching having so many hurdles they have to, you know, kind of overcome before they reach the effectiveness. And then he goes into this paraprofessional piece, so.
Yeah. No, you're right. And he does at one point say something about, like, there could be experts in, like, social-emotional, so maybe that mm-hmm. would be SPED teachers. But, yeah, he does get, I think he sort of sees paras as supporting with accommodations, which mm-hmm. makes sense, mm-hmm. and I sort of like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, he talks about this peer support a lot, which mm-hmm. I found really interesting. And it was interesting. Shortly after I read this, We had the same student I was talking about last time, actually, a student who struggles with behavior, and we had emailed her teachers and said, hey, we need, you know, we've updated her behavior plan, and she needs support in the following areas. And one of the things we put in is, like, peers need to be encouraged to not give her attention for negative behavior.
Mm.
And a general education teacher replied and said, I don't think it's peers' job to implement her behavior plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, hmm. And it was right after I read this, and I was like, interesting, because he's sort of explicitly saying, mm-hmm. recruit peers to support students.
Mm-hmm.
And this teacher immediately pushed back. And on the one hand, I was like, well, I can see where you're coming from, and you're not wrong that they're not her educators. On the other hand, asking them to ignore problem behavior is not the same as, like, asking them to teach her to read.
Right. Yeah, I see what you mentioned there. I see as more of a classroom management request, and encouragement from the teacher to not allow other students to reinforce behaviors that aren't functional for the environment,
yeah.
right? I mean, you're asking a teacher to do that, but
sounds like here he's asking for more. Like, for example, he has type of need mobility.
And then
and he says peer support.
Which I know. And I think we've worked together once before with a student who had issues. She used a wheelchair and therefore had issues carrying a lot of her things around. And then we had peers that were helping her move around the building and carry books and things, which is a whole nother level of messiness when kids aren't getting to their own classes in time. Mm-hmm. And then they start to use that as an excuse. And then they like to ride the elevator. And then, you know, right. there's just
and
all
then
these.
She ran over somebody's foot with her wheelchair. And like, yes. who's liable for that?
Right.
I mean, it was a friend and it was fine, but.
I know, but it's those types of things that make you, it just adds a level of complexity that with the limited time that we have, it makes it difficult to go that next step and try to get a peer to do the appropriate things. And
well, and I almost feel like, have you been a teenager? Like, this is going to interact with the student with disabilities, social life, and the other peer. Like, he also has social protection. Peer support. So you're going to have a student maybe with autism and another peer is protecting them?
I know.
And like, that's weird for both the student with autism and for the peer. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're setting up both of them to not have friends in an age-appropriate way.
Right.
Which maybe they like, but should we be endorsing? It's like, you're now a teacher light and like, you're not going to socialize with your peers in an actually
right.
peer relation. That's gross to
me. I know. I do think this harkens, or I don't know, it reminds me of inclusion models, especially for elementary areas or elementary levels, but where you're talking about community. You're building community. Everybody is a part of your community, and how do we help everybody be better in our community? Ideally, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But when I think in a situation, and I don't mean to be a negative Nelly, but I do think when you deal with teacher turnover, increased level of expectations on teachers, we can't even get enough teachers, you know, in some cases to fill the open positions. So I don't know how you then hope you're going to have, or not really hope, because at this point you would be requiring that level of classroom management,
yeah.
which really takes skill, which is what he mentions with the co-teaching,
yeah.
but doesn't seem to acknowledge for that really working well in a classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a really good point. And maybe it's possible, like what you're saying, like building community, like maybe he's envisioning it's not one peer that would support the child in the wheelchair, like transporting her materials. It's, you know, it's her class as a whole, which is fine. But like, we all know the research shows that if you say somebody call 911, nobody calls 911.
Mm-hmm.
So to rely on, we hope that, you know, a variety of students will step up is just, that's not how humans as social animals work.
Right. And when I have relied on that type of model, something always comes up, which then you say, oh, well, prepare for those things. But like one time it was the student that was supposed to help was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was early enough in the day that nobody knew. And there's just so many moving parts that it was nearly impossible. Then I think at one point also, like, I had one student who knew the student's combination or how to run the locker, and then that student was gone, or they overshared the information. I can't quite remember.
Now her locker's not secure.
Yeah, it became a big to-do. And so in that regard, sometimes it's more reliable to require things of a paid staff member because it's more controlled.
Maybe he would see like a para potentially supporting in the organization of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which I think is fine. But then again, I think you're in danger of recruiting students into like baby teachers,
mm-hmm.
which I don't.
And I get it. I bet that somebody listening who supports 100% inclusion would be saying, no, these, like, have high expectations. When you have high expectations, these things will work out.
Yeah.
I think that sometimes it does, but it's almost like one of those where everything just happens to fall in line and it works, but it's not reasonable for the daily.
Right. When it becomes maybe person dependent, mm-hmm. like that one student has the personality that just makes mm-hmm. it work, or that mm-hmm. one staff member is able to work with those people. And whenever something's dependent on one person, it makes me leery, because that means that person is out sick, or that person's a military spouse and moves to Florida, mm-hmm. then your entire system falls apart, which, I mean, those things happen anyway, but we shouldn't build a system on the assumption that the one person will always mm-hmm. carry it. Mm-hmm. The system should be built to be to work regardless.
Right.
That should be the goal.
Right. And you could say, in relation to classroom management, well, no, it doesn't fall on one person, and all these students know how to help, because everybody does have individualized needs and yeah. that sort of thing. So then, but what I see happening there is that it could become a free-for-all, or the student that wants to be extra pleasing is the one that always does it, or the student that is wanting to please gets in the way because mm-hmm. they yeah. are overly eager.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and you made me think of something else, like the whole generalist to specialist thing makes me think that, yeah, in order to have that work, you really need that strong community. But if you're doing those specialist thing and this teacher's moving from groups of kids and maybe moving schools, that erodes mm-hmm. the exact community you need.
Yeah.
So, that's which he doesn't thing. Address.
No.
He doesn't address that when you're itinerant, it's hard to feel community. Mm-hmm. And even something simple like to know that kid walking in the hall and know that if they're walking in the hall, that's probably a bad sign. And maybe mm-hmm. you know that if you live in the school.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just a random kid in the hall.
Right. It is an interesting, I don't know, conundrum or problem, because when you think about the pressure that creates and then maintains systems, there is a reason why things are the way they currently are. And while he might see options for working outside, that may be possible for 25%. But when you're running a large system, it is not possible. Mm-hmm. Again, it might happen one school, one teacher, one year, and then be
yeah.
done.
And he's, I think you're exactly right, and he's not really addressing that inertia. Mm-hmm. The fact that there might be valid reasons behind the inertia, and that even if there aren't valid reasons, it's possible that the people within the system will mm-hmm. be resistant. Mm-hmm. And in his defense, he wrote this book before, like, the pandemic and before the teacher shortage, but right. I wonder if now he might comment differently, because frankly, if I were a district leader, I would be very cautious about alienating my staff because there aren't enough staff. Mm-hmm. And he seems to be like, yeah, people would be resistant, but you'll win them over. It'll be fine.
Wait till you see the great things that happen.
And I feel like in 2024, I'm less clear on that. Mm-hmm. And I would tread more cautiously if someone said, but I don't want to just teach reading all day. Mm-hmm. I would be more cautious about that because nobody else is lining up to just teach reading either.
Right.
So our next shift, which we'll save for our next session, is about social, emotional, and behavioral needs. So that one will be a doozy, and he did devote 2 chapters to it. So I'm expecting that we both will have lots of thoughts about that one.
Yes, I agree.
Education and education.